St. Stephen's has the unique distinction of being the only traditionalist parish actually founded by the Prayer Book Society of the Episcopal Church. And I strongly suspect the Society's national leaders were anything but pleased with its Baltimore chapter's declaration of independence from the Episcopal Church. Back in the 1980s, the Society's official policy was to try to persuade the Episcopal Church's House of Bishops to reach an accommodation with clergy and laity who wanted to preserve the traditional prayer book liturgy. Its leaders seemed blissfully unaware, or even perhaps willfully ignorant, of the fact that the argument had little to do with the merits of the language of the traditional English liturgy versus the stripped-down modern version in the 1979 book, but rather the theology expressed in the liturgy. The proponents of the 1979 prayer book knew that if the traditional liturgy continued in use alongside the new book, the departures from theological orthodoxy they planned to impose on the church would be rather more difficult to institute. In any event, the members of the Baltimore chapter of the Society were made of sterner stuff than the national leadership. They realized that an awful lot more than aesthetics were involved, and thus in 1982 they brought St. Stephen's into being. One of the prime movers was a former member of St. Michael and All Angels, the famous downtown Baltimore church. His name was Fred Hines. He was a radio and television pioneer, and he made a fortune from the sale of his interest in a large Maryland media company which owned TV and radio stations throughout the mid-Atlantic states. Fred believed that the best way to preserve doctrinal orthodoxy was to foster the planting of traditional parishes throughout the United States. A canny corporate strategist and a skilled money manager, he put his expertise and a large chunk of his fortune at the service of the Anglican traditionalist movement. Some of St. Stephen's founders looked forward to Fred to donate the lion's share of the cash needed to construct a church building for the newly founded St. Stephen's. But fortunately, he did nothing of the sort. Fred realized that for the parish to survive, its members needed financial skin in the game. Instead, Fred, a shy, self-effacing fellow, worked behind the scenes, acting by turns in the roles of de facto chief executive, chief fundraiser, and chief strategist, doing everything necessary to keep the project going forward. It's fair to say that without him, the parish would never have survived. At the same time as working to build St. Stephen's, Fred developed a broad national strategy to promote and foster the Anglican traditionalist movement. The Information Centre's role was to provide communications, research and clerical services for newly planted parishes. It helped with costs of advertising as well as the more mundane matters such as printing of orders of service and the like. More important of all, in the days before the internet, it provided the free telecommunications services to clergy and lay people. As director of the centre, Fred appointed Bishop Albion Knight, a man who'd squared the theological circle by combining a military and ecclesiastical career, achieving both promotion to the rank of Brigadier General and consecration to the episcopate. By virtue of the fact that he was based in Towson, Bishop Knight, as presiding bishop of the United Episcopal Church, presided episcopal oversight for St. Stephen's, and eventually the parish joined the jurisdiction of which he was the presiding bishop, the United Episcopal Church. My own association with the Anglican traditionalist movement began soon after our family arrived here early in 1980. Initially, being a Brit, I didn't have much of a dog in the fight, beyond being aghast at the ugliness of the Episcopal Church's new liturgies. The Bishop of New York's attachment to Marxism was also distressing. He was a prime example of Lenin's useful idiot, an active supporter of the communist guerrilla movement in Nicaragua and Namibia, as well as an advocate of unilateral nuclear disarmament. In any event, by the mid-1980s or so, I found myself under the authority of Bishop Knight, who, to put it mildly, was an aggressively low churchman. It was not an entirely comfortable arrangement. I'm a son of both the Church of Ireland and also the English High Church, a combination which encompasses both ends of the liturgical spectrum. I was thus more tolerant of ecclesiastical eccentricities than the bishop. Bishop Knight's activities, despite protestations to the contrary, did little to advance the cause of unity in the traditionalist movement. As a consequence, our relationship deteriorated somewhat following my election as president of his Council of Advice. The bishop seemed perpetually engaged in wrestling against principalities, against powers, against rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Actually defined mainly by fellow traditionalists who didn't share his liturgical and theological tastes, or who did not agree with his political manoeuvrings. Occasionally, he even appeared to take his council advice as an enemy. For example, we clashed over his acceptance of an invitation to consecrate in sole, in other words alone, a bishop of the English Protestant Reformation Society. A consecration is usually considered irregular when fewer than three bishops take part. Our objections were fourfold. One, the Protestant Reformation Society as a whole denied the sacramental nature of the Church. Two, their candidate for the episcopate disavowed the sacramental nature of the episcopate. Three, he'd not been properly elected by any properly constituted body. Four, the proposed consecration would not only be irregular, but by virtue of the candidate's sacramental beliefs, it would also be invalid. As was his wont, Bishop Knight gleefully ignored the advice and went ahead anyway. However, the bishop suffered intermittently from heart trouble, and during the consecration service, just before the prayers of consecration, he collapsed on the floor. Folks less convinced of their own rectitude might have interpreted this as a sign that the Holy Spirit was not entirely pleased with what was going on. But Bishop Knight was made of sterner stuff. He told the candidate to lie down beside him and proceeded with the consecration prone. A few wags proposed notifying the Guinness Book of Records that this was the lowest episcopal consecration that had ever taken place. But mercifully, more sober heads prevailed, and church unity was preserved at least for a while longer. But in any event, St. Stephen's resisted Bishop Knight's pressure to become an inclusively low church institution. Instead, we opted to serve Episcopalians of as wide a spectrum of liturgical tastes as possible. Or, as the old saw puts it, low and lazy, high and crazy, broad and hazy. And by and large, I think we've succeeded.